at it, as well as playing how number of spins without touching anything. So a fun look at what has been going on inside.
Let me take you, ladies and gentlemen.
And the name is German to represent Matthias Maurer. So everyone is represented by their 0G indicator.
Yeah, they look like they are having a blast in space here. Next up, in about 10 minutes, we are waiting for an out-of-plane burn. This burn is an optional firing of Dragon's thrusters if it isn't exactly where it needs to be after launch, and the rendezvous burns before the spacecraft go into approach initiation. Again, it seems like we will be needing this, and the delta and duration will vary depending on how the previous rendezvous phase burns performed, but it's basically like a fine-tuning option for us before Dragon begins its final approach phase to the International Space Station.
Handover is happening here in Mission Control Houston, so if the room is looking a little fuller, that is why. They're handing off to the third team of the day, known as Orbit 3. This will be the team on console that will be here once Crew Dragon docks to the space station, currently scheduled for 6:33 p.m. Eastern, 3:33 p.m. Pacific. This handover period allows offgoing operators to share with the oncoming operators what has gone on during their shift, anything that they're tracking, or anything that they are looking forward to.
Yeah, we've been helping provide continuous coverage of the crew's liftoff and approach to the International Space Station. The crew has been in space for about 18 hours now, and again, we're just under 3 hours away from them docking to the International Space Station.
As we've mentioned, the Crew Dragon's name is Endurance. This is a pattern, or a tradition, I should say, since the beginning of the U.S. space program. Astronauts have had the opportunity to name their spacecraft, starting with Alan Shepard naming his spacecraft Freedom 7 during the Mercury program. In keeping with this tradition, each of the NASA Dragon spacecraft astronaut crews has also had the opportunity to select a name for their Dragon.
Crew 3 has chosen the name Endurance for their Dragon, which Roger Chari, the spacecraft commander, has said is a tribute to the tenacity of the human spirit. The crew has also expressed that the name acknowledges the teams of people who endured through a pandemic to make this mission possible. Endurance will be joining Endeavour. That was the Corps announcing that the out-of-plane burn is happening in about 7 minutes. Again, the spacecraft Endurance will be joining Endeavour and Resilience as the third NASA Crew Dragon spacecraft to take astronauts to the International Space Station.
We continue to answer your questions with the hashtag AskNASA on Twitter. This one wondering what kind of things are being taken up with the crew on Crew Dragon today.
So lots of science. Space flight affects human bodies in numerous ways, including how the immune system functions. The food physiology investigation documents it's the effect of dietary improvements will also improve immune function and the gut microbiome, and if those improvements can help crews get better adapted to spaceflight. An enhanced understanding of food's effects on physiology and microgravity can help scientists continue to improve the spaceflight diet and crew health. So resupply hardware for the food physiology study is on the Crew Dragon spacecraft along with the crew three astronauts. Once in orbit, the astronauts will collect biological samples to provide data to scientists back on the ground for continued study of how dietary changes affect living in microgravity. In addition to this, hardware to support new science on board station. The Crew Dragon is carrying more than 400 pounds of NASA cargo, which includes crew supplies, spacewalking equipment, and equipment for more scientific investigations.
And once Dragon's ready to come home, the teams will pack several hundred pounds of cargo inside the capsule to return to teams on Earth. When Crew 2 returned on Monday, they carried more than 530 pounds of hardware and science staples for researchers on Earth to analyze. Those are coming from more than a dozen research projects. They also might bring home any old or failed parts from station systems, which gives technicians on the ground a chance to analyze hardware up close and potentially refurbish and refly parts to the station. We're about 2.5 minutes out from the approach initiation out of plane burn. We have time for another question. How is the vestibule pressurized from the International Space Station, and what pressure is the space station kept at? Well, it is pressurized very slowly. So when Crew Dragon docks to the station, there is a vacuum created between its hatch and the hatch on the station side. We slowly let air into that space until it is the same pressure as what's inside the International Space Station. The International Space Station is kept at about 14.7 pounds per square inch, which is similar to what we would experience at sea level on Earth.
Again, SpaceX. We just went through submarine comms. I'm not sure if you think
SpaceX endure. So we go to still the floater camera. You guys still powering them?
Roger, you go to still the floater cam and just went through a period of ready comm. Not sure if you heard the prior calls, but we're 1 minute to the out of plane burn.
Negative, we didn't hear the prior calls, but copy 1 minute to the out of plane burn. We're starting to clean up the cabin here in preparation for eventual suit-downing.
And the approach initiation burn has begun. We are tracking, or the approach initiation out of plane burn. We're tracking stiff burn progress.
Dragon, SpaceX, burn complete, out of plane burn nominal. Next up is approach initiation for displays.
Dirt sees the same. Hour and 12 minutes, just next burn.
We copy and concur.
And we just heard confirmation of a good approach initiation out of plane burn. So next we'll be waiting for Dragon to give the go for approach. Once we get that go, at approximately 2:06 p.m. Pacific, Draco thrusters, or 2:06 p.m. Eastern, Draco thrusters on Dragon will fire for the approach initiation burn when Dragon's about 2.5 kilometers below station and just about 7 kilometers behind it. This will swing Dragon up until it's about 400 meters or a quarter mile directly below the station.
This maneuver will also move Dragon inside one of two checkpoints around the station that requires a set of go-no-go poles with the different control teams. The first checkpoint is called the approach ellipsoid, or as you might hear, be called the AE. It's an imaginary shape measuring 4 kilometers by 2 kilometers by 2 kilometers, essentially a large three-dimensional oval, and before Dragon is given permission to move inside the approach ellipsoid, the capsule is configured to be what is known as a 24-hour safe trajectory. It means that if Dragon were to lose control of its thrusters for some reason, it would be at least 24 hours before its trajectory would move inside the approach ellipsoid.
The approach ellipsoid and the keep-out sphere, which would be next, these are both invisible lines around the station that are monitored by flight controllers here in Houston, and they monitor these for any visiting vehicles arriving and departing at the station, regardless of the vehicle provider and what is on it, be it crew or cargo. It's been fantastic to join you for this continuous coverage today of Crew 3's journey to the International Space Station, and thank you for all of your excellent questions. I encourage you to continue sharing those with the hashtag AskNASA. I'll be stepping off, and you'll be joined by my coworker and colleague, that is Ms. Sandra Jones. Thank you again for allowing me to help take you on this journey today. Go Crew 3, go SpaceX, and go NASA.
If you want to get into crypto, you need to check out Coinbase. Coinbase is the primary platform for buying, selling, earning, and learning about crypto.
Yes.
And then next to that, it says ICP.
That's correct.
Okay, what does that mean?
Means that the interpolation algorithm that was selected was by Qubit.
Are there other interpolation methods that you could use?
There is, yes.
And what are some of those?
For example, nearest neighbor is one, by Qubit, by linear.
And can I just ask you to do this? So the photo that you get a lot of at the stage request, how much is it pixels that you expand? What do you do to make it bigger?
It's based off of the enlargement is the interpolation that is used. So with regards to this, this references a video that was interpolated and outputted. Are you speaking to... I'm sorry, are you speaking to the photo?
Yeah, speaking to photo, what number is
it? It's the one of eight. We're short.
So this is Ben Mark in stage 155. I'm going to ask specifically about that one.
Okay.
Okay. So you have taken a still of a video and you have zoomed in, for lack of a better
term. I would not say zoom. I would say it would spin enlarged.
And how do you do that?
We use a algorithm, by cubic algorithm, for that. For this particular, are you referring to both images or just one?
They're both the same, right?
This one was used with a smart resize algorithm, and then this one is used by cubic.
I'm sorry, you said this one was smart size?
Smart resize.
And what is that?
That is a algorithm that is part of the AMP5 software that resizes that image.
So, I don't know if this is going to be easier for me to do it this way. I don't know if the court will be easier for the court. But in my... Tell me this is right. Can you just turn it to for a second? Okay. So, you are making things in large. Right, you are you adding pixels?
Yes, I am adding pixels.
Okay. And so tell me if this is by Qubit interpolation. And I know this will be rudimentary, but forgive me. So if these are pixels, I was gonna say for red. And these are red. And these are pixels, and these are blue. When you enlarge an image, what does the bi-cubic algorithm do to these pixels?
The bi-cubic algorithm is taking those pixels and resampling, or I'm sorry, is basically duplicating those pixels into another area. Beyond that, I can't say.
Do you know, based on your training and experience, what color the bi-cubic algorithm makes these pixels?
I do not know.
Do you know if it makes, do we know this is a red pixel? And we know this is a blue pixel, and those are real colors.
Mm-hmm.
Will it combine these two pixel colors to actually change the color of the image? You know what I'm saying?
I can't speak to that.
So you can't, I want to be clear. The assigned ones that you have in the middle?
Yes.
Those are the added ones?
Yes.
Okay.
So the added pixels, and what, to be fair, in terms of what we're looking for to make sure the color is correct, that we're not distorting the color of the thing we're looking at, is adding pixels my concern, my question for you is it adding the correct color of the original image?
That goes beyond into the algorithm of the program that I do not have that information for.
Okay, so if I can ask you this. These two photographs that you have enlarged,
mm-hmm.
okay, so you added pixels to those, right?
Correct.
Okay. And are you able to tell the court the colors that were there originally are actually the same colors when I expand or enlarge the photograph with the added pixels? Are you able to say that?
I'm not able to say that, no.
So you, I'm not, tell me if I'm right. So the things that the court would be looking at
mm-hmm.
and the colors that the court would be looking at, you can't tell the court that in fact that's the color from the original picture, correct?
It comes down to the programming, the algorithm, I cannot say it.
Can I just say one second, sir? Yeah. I have a couple questions for you, sir. Could you have used another algorithm that wouldn't have changed the potential color of the pixels that you had?
There's no testimony that the color has been changed. There's been no testimony that the color has been changed.
It was my impression, and I beg your correction, it was my impression that in the effort to enlarge the image, that the individual is inserting some, I'm going to call them uncharged pixels, that the algorithm is going to assign colors, which is beyond its control. Where am I going wrong?
My question was, could he have used a different algorithm?
You're past me. I'm just trying to understand if I've got the basic concept down.
My understanding was it was beyond his scope of his expertise.
I'm still using watercolors. He is enlarging. He wants to enlarge the image, and he's inserting some pixels in there. And so he gives it a command to insert the pixels, and he doesn't know what color they're going to come up. Is that it? Is that it, sir?
I would say, Your Honor, it's as to how that algorithm interpolates those pixels and where it places them goes outside the scope of my knowledge.
Well, what do we, in no disrespect, what do you know?
What I do know is that the process that I use to expand or enlarge this image and the interpolation method that was used. Anything beyond that within my software, with the software I use, I do not have any additional information.
And competing programs might insert different colors.
It's possible.
And you wouldn't have any way of knowing.
I would not. I do not have any way to know if those different interpolation methods would issue different colors to different pixels.
What I had asked him was, I wasn't telling you anything, but I asked the question that was sent to, which was there another method that could have been used, which, and I think the wording that I had said was, wouldn't have changed the pixel colors, which I drew the objection.
And what was the objection?
The objection is not testimony that any colors were changed.
How do you know?
He may or may not, but the way he asked it is assuming that colors changed.
I'll have you rephrase.
But
is there another interpolation type of program that you're aware of that when pixels are expanded would keep the color constant through the expansion?
I cannot speak to that.
Would you agree the more pixels they can add, the more interpolation happens?
Yes.
So the question that I have is, when you expand the photograph, you're adding pixels, but you can't tell the court what color is being added in it.
I cannot speak to that. Now that comes down to the programming algorithm on the software.
So the original system has colors and pixels. It's expanded. Those pixels expand. The question is, do the colors stay constant?
I do not know.
That's all I have. Mr. Armstrong, is the software you use similar to the input software?
It's similar.
So the same algorithms and methods, as far as you know, are also in that software?
It's both softwares are made by two different manufacturers. I can't comment on whether they're the same.
So when you enlarge these images, are you changing any details?
I am not changing any details.
What are you doing?
We are simply just adding pixels to make the image larger.
Because when you're looking at the smaller image on the screen, say it's 20 by 30 pixels. In order to enlarge that, there need to be more than 20 by 30 pixels, also stay the same size.
That's correct.
So you didn't witness this, but the defense expert was zooming in on video with his software. Would that also be adding pixels because they're enlarging it?
Is it relevant for purposes of what his testimony would be?
I'm trying to help the court understand. I
beg your pardon?
I'm trying to get an understanding of how this works.
Oh, go ahead. So.
You may answer if you can.
I do not know as to input is on how their interpolation for, if any, is seen by zooming in on there.
So, in general, by adding pixels, the only way to enlarge an image is to add pixels.
Correct.
Now, you don't go in and say, put in black pixels, put in blue pixels, or anything like that.
That is correct. I do not.
The software program does that.
That is correct.
And it has to do that to actually make the image larger.
That is correct.
Now, is this the defense expert called EF5 the gold standard of video editing? Is it one of the best programs out there?
It is a program that we use at the lab, yes.
Now, is it an accepted program? I'm sorry?
You asked him who is the best one, and he responded that's what we use at the lab. That's not the same thing, or it doesn't establish that it is in fact the best.
I understand.
Not everything the state supplies is top notch. And I'm not talking about the judges, by the way. I said not everything the state supplies is top notch.
So is this the same process as when you get like full screen on your computer?
No.
Now, this AMS5 software has an algorithm.
And in speaking to, exactly.
When you interpolate, there's an algorithm that fills in the image so that you can actually see it, so that it's magnified.
When you are dealing with looking at it from a preview, it uses its own nearest neighbor, but it does not add pixels in that preview.
So these processes you use, are these the standards used in the forensic imaging that you do?
Yes.
And this is the kind of software that you are trained on?
Yes.
And this is an accepted software program in forensic imaging?
Yes.
And it is these are accepted procedures in forensic imaging?
Yes.
And that's all. Thank you.
So, here's my question. The photograph that we're talking about to be admitted into evidence and to have people look at,
yes.
You can't, can you say that that image didn't add color into pixels that weren't there originally?
I cannot definitively say that because I did not write the software program.
So it's possible when you enlarge an image in X pixels that you're adding colors that weren't there in your original photographs, correct?
I do not know.
And when you said nearest neighbor, nearest neighbor, if I'm right, tell me. What color goes in here on a nearest neighbor?
It utilizes, I'm sorry, I do not know.
Would it become purple?
It's possible.
And purple is nowhere on here, is it?
That is correct.
Nothing else.
In order to answer Frosty's questions, would you have needed to written the algorithm in the software program?
I would need to, yes, and see exactly how those programs are interpolating those pixels.
Do you ever check the enlarged image against the original image and see if there are consistencies?
Yes, we can certainly compare the original to the enhanced version.
And is your work, and were these images and your work on these images peer-reviewed by another forensic imaging specialist?
Yes, that's correct.
Nothing further.
I have a motion, but I don't have anything else to ask.
You can step down, sir.
Based on his testimony, so what the state is trying to do is introduce a photograph that has been enlarged where this person, Mr. Armstrong, cannot testify that, in fact, colors weren't added that weren't there originally. And the photograph, I'm going to tell the court that the photograph that the state intends to offer, I believe they will be arguing, shows Mr. Rittenhouse doing something with his firearm. If it is not the same as the original and colors were added to that, that is the distortion of what, in fact, the original photograph was. It should not be admitted because it's not relevant if he can't testify. There's been no appropriate foundation that, in fact, it should be admitted if he can't testify that it didn't add colors, that colors that originally weren't there still aren't there. And I think under the circumstances, based on the evidence that you've heard today, you should not admit those photographs because they are not what I would consider to be mirror images of what the original photograph was.
Judge, all due respect to Your Honor, I think the defense is trying to take advantage of your lack of knowledge about technology, which you've expressed. With the defense argument, you could never have an enlarged digital picture. All of Nathan, and I understand you didn't object to them, but all of Nathan DeBruin's pictures that he brought in on his own on these prints are enlarged digital images. If the defense is now trying to argue that enlarged digital images are not reliable, I mean, it's, first of all, hypocritical, but second of all, this is just not the age we're in. We are in an age where software is able to
enlarge and do things. And yes, this image, we believe, although blurry because of the enlargement, does show, in rebuttal to Mr. Rittenhouse's testimony, does show him pointing his gun at individuals just before Mr. Rosenbaum chases him. The defense, this is clear, the drone video, we pointed it out in the drone video, the defendant denied it. This is an enlargement of that drone video so that we can see a better picture of it. This whole canard of adding pixels and changing color is a dishonest argument. I believe the defense knows that. Their expert used a very similar software to zoom in and edit and change things, because if these things are reliable, and they are reliable, and this is what is used by digital for, or by forensic imaging, forensic scientists, it's the industry standard. So if we're going to say that no technology can be brought in, no enlarged images can ever be brought in, that is a ridiculous standard. And that, and we've heard from two experts now about how these algorithms are used and what they do, and simply because this evidence may be not beneficial to their client, and in fact, so their client is lying, they're stupid at this level to try and keep it out. And to me, I think making a dishonest argument based on science, based on a number of science, forensic scientists that have emailed me to discuss this issue with the Apple zooming, which I think was also very similarly, I don't want to say dishonest, but inaccurate argument, simply trying to keep out these enlarged or cleaned up images that show that their client is lying. He pointed a gun before Joseph Rosenbaum chased him. And this is a rebuttal. This is rebuttal evidence. This is based on someone trained in this area who uses software that is certified in this area. He's trained in this area. This is what these forensic image specialists do. They're, and it's peer-reviewed by other forensic images, which, frankly, Dr. Black is not. And so this is actually a much higher standard than the evidence that Dr. Black got in. I understand what he suggests. But for them to have an expert come in, use a very similar software to use similar things, and then try to pretend this is all voodoo magic is preposterous. And
wait, wait. A couple of things. Number one, this happens sometimes. Lawyers sit there during the trial and all kinds of stuff comes in and out, and there's no objection raised. And then when there is an objection raised, the party says, well, this went on before in the trial and it was admitted. And I think, okay, but there was an objection. So it was never scrutinized by the court. It just came in. That's number one. Number two, you're the proponent of the evidence. You have the burden of proof. They don't have to disprove the accuracy of it. You have to prove it. Number three, the witness was just here, and when he's asked, what does it depict in terms of whether the color is going to change or to what color, he says, I don't know. Now, this is the person who is providing your information to support your claim that it is an accurate depiction. I will tell you that I totally agree with your comment about my lack of familiarity with these concepts. Although logic, I have some logical skills, and when you start adding, if I take this piece of paper and I start drawing squares on it, and I decide I'm going to put it on a bigger piece of paper, and I want to expand them, but I do it by creating even more squares, and I don't know what's going to go into those other squares. I mean, this is difficult a concept for me, yes. You know, the fact that I can blow something up on my phone, and it's accurate on my phone, doesn't mean that the particular program used by the crime lab is doing an accurate job of increasing the size of the image.
Well, this is an accredited lab using software
that... What does that mean to me? What does peer reviewed mean to me? If you haven't presented any evidence as to the science or as to the algorithm that's involved. I want to see the images.
Okay.
Let's take a look. Not that my naked eye is going to be necessarily capable of making the distinction that I need to make, but you've got the burden here, so you.
Oh, I understand.
Present the images. I'll take a look at them.
Would you like them on the printed out paper, or would you like them on the screen? We have two of them marked, or we can put them on the screen.
All of them, you got to have. All of them.
Yeah, you better put them up. I'm getting to get anything out of these at all. Actually, I've had the best success looking at this one. Now, what is this depicting?
Judge, this is a image from the drone video. It's the exact area where Mr. Rittenhouse looked and denied that that is him holding his weapon, pointing it at Zeminski.
Okay, now you tell me, where's Zeminski, where's the defendant, where's...
Zeminski is off screen because he has to be cropped. The defendant...
I beg your pardon?
Zeminski is, I believe, off screen. The defendant is right under the sign, right in front of what the pole holding up the sign. And right next to him is the fire extinguisher that, as opposed to his actual testimony, is seen on the drone video gently placing on the ground. He then immediately raises up and raises his firearm and points it at the Zeminski. The defendant denied this even after watching the drone video. This is an enhanced, this is a blown up image. Obviously, it's blurry because it is blown up. But you can see the black firearm being held in his two hands, albeit it is blurry. If you'd like to see the video where this came from, you can show that to me as well.
Let's check that.
Add that up?
Yep.
Number 82, please.
Brian, 82.
In that area of that, it's clear on the 4K TV, which is why I believe the defense brought that in. It's clear on the 4K TV, which is the one the defense brought in, but the area where that enhances is, as the video begins,
this way.
As the video begins, if you look under that sign, you will see the defendant step into view. He gently places his fire extinguisher on the ground. And then he raises up and points his weapon at Zeminski, so I believe you can see once this light turns on out of the way. You can play it, Brian. Please do it one more time, Mr. Shute.
You don't want zero problems, big fella.
Yup.
If one more label try to stop me, it's gonna be some dreadhead niggas in your lobby.
What I'm going to do is allow it and witness is going to be cross-examined for a down, please? Hey, you.
This time, because we move into exhibit 142 and 140, and we would rest.
All right. Any objection to 142 and 140?
To final review of 142, no.
All right, Mr. Steve. Did you wish to present about it?
Yes. Series called James Armstrong to the stand.
You're still there.
Thank you. You testified a few days ago about some videos from a drone footage that were entered into evidence.
Yes.
Did you do any additional work on that drone footage?
Yes, it was requested that I enhance a person near a vehicle underneath the sign.
And how did you go about doing that?
I took two different approaches. The first one, I frame averaged, which means that I selected a group of frames from there, frame average. From there, I frame averaged those, stabilized first, then frame averaged. From there, went through and clarified it, which means that we're using levels, we just brightened it up, and then enlarged it.
And these practices you talked about, are these standards in the forensic imaging world?
They are, yes.
And so are these accepted practices in forensic imaging?
They are.
The software you used, is it accepted software program in forensic imaging?
Yes.
And was your work on these images did it go through the peer review process?
I went through a peer review process by another qualified analyst.
And did you write this software?
I did not write this software.
And this enlargement, does it use any kind of computer programs or systems to make the enlargement?
Yes, it uses an algorithm to enlarge that image.
And what kind of process or algorithm was used for the image with the individual under the sign?
For the image underneath the sign, the image that is on towards the left, a smart resize, and then the image on the right was by Cubic.
And are these accepted procedures in forensic imaging?
Yes.
Yes, that's correct.
And did you write the algorithms that do these procedures?
I did not, no.
So do you know the actual specifics of how the algorithms work?
I do not know.
But they're part of a software program that is accepted in use in forensic imaging.
Yes, that's correct.
Uh, is, but again, I don't know that he's going to get the witness to grasp an answer that he wouldn't otherwise make, so the objections are low.
What is the software that you used?
It is called AMP5.
We've heard some testimony today about a
software program called Input Ace. Is that a similar software program, to the best of your knowledge, to AMP5?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
To the best of your knowledge, did the crime lab have to choose between those two as to which software they would use?
Yes, the AMP5 was chosen.
Were you part of that process?
I was only part of the process of making the recommendation.
Is that what you recommended?
That was my choice, yes.
Sorry?
That was my choice.
Oh, well. I think you said it was your choice.
It was my recommendation to our technical unit leader for... Sorry. It was my recommendation to our technical unit leader for my preference of software between the two.
I want you to listen, Mark, at Space Exhibit 155. Do you recognize this?
Yes, that appears to be the report print that I created. A report print.
And this report print has two images on it?
That is correct.
And is it a true and accurate representation of the report you created?
It appears to be so, yes.
And you said there were some differences between the algorithms used on the images?
Yes, that is correct.
And what is the difference?
The difference being is that with regards to the clarification techniques on the image on the left, that was frame averaging. The image on the right, the difference being is that just a single frame was used.
And I put a piece of paper down in front of you. Do you mind flipping that over? What's the number on top of that one?
Exhibit S156.
Do you recognize that?
Yes, that is report print number two.
And what is report print number two?
Report print number two is clarified and enlarged files or images that I produced.
And where were the, what, I'm sorry, where were you looking to enhance these images from?
We were looking to enhance the position, the area where the two individuals are observed.
And so this is a different part of the drone video than the first exhibit?
That is correct.
What did you do to produce these images?
To produce these images, I just, again, clarified. So I use levels to brighten it up and then also to enlarge as well.
And all the procedures you used, standard and accepted in forensic imaging?
Yes, that is correct.
Well, you actually created six more reports as well?
Correct, yes.
And just to not go through every one, were they all created with standards of forensic imaging?
Yes, that is correct.
You reviewed them and you know that the ones that the state's submitting are the ones that you submitted to us?
That is correct.
At this point, I would like to move all eight into evidence and publish 155 and 156 to the jury.
Right. Well, they're admitted subject to the cross-examination.
So, can I publish them?
Not yet.
Okay. I have a further question. I'm going to use this. Starbucks, you can't see this, can you?
I can partially see it.
All right. I just want to make sure that I'm really curious. Okay.
All right, so.
So,
In terms of your enlarging this image, from the information that's been provided to us, you did that through a bicubic interpolation program. Is that right?
I provided that through a smart resize and also bicubic, depending upon the image that you're referring to.
Okay. And when you're making the image larger, you're adding pixels to that image. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. So my question to you in terms of your work on this is, in a situation where each individual pixel you agree has a color, if there's color involved, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So if these pixels are blue, and we know from the original that these pixels are red, when you're expanding the image, you're adding pixels, correct?
You are adding pixels, yes.
You don't know when you're adding and enlarging that and adding pixels. You don't know what color you're adding to these pixels. Is that right?
I do not know the interpolation, the algorithm, what it exactly is doing when it's adding those pixels.
There are programs, if I'm right, are there programs that would just default it blue, even though it might not be?
I do not know.
Do you know if there's a program? Do you know if there's programs that would take the blue pixel and the red pixel, combine them, and make a color purple when it's actually not purple?
I do not know.
Does it change? So here's the question I have. So if you take a picture of me right here and you expand it and blow it up, it's going to add pixels, so it might change. The pixels could become white for the color of my shirt or black for the color of my tie, correct?
It's going to be sampling the pixels that from your example.
Yeah.
And and calculating those pixels out and then duplicating those pixels into that image.
Yeah, can you say
that again? What was your answer? I'm sorry, could you repeat your question?
What we're doing here, what you've done is you've taken a still photograph, right?
Yes.
You've blown it up and added pixels to that photograph.
That is correct.
Okay. Those pixels have to contain or do contain information, right?
That is correct.
Some of that information is color, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So the best example I would give you is if you take a picture of my chest, my shirt, and you blow it up, you're going to be adding pixels around my shirt and my tie, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, so the question is this. In terms of the accuracy of that enlarged image, you don't know whether those pixels are black for my tie or white for my shirt, right?
I cannot speak to the algorithm that's being used and how it's interpreting that.
And that, to be fair, that could distort or not make an accurate picture of what we're seeing, right?
It's possible.
Right. So the images, and when we're looking at smaller images that are blown up, adding color that's not actually there can make the photograph not accurate, right?
But all the stuff that were taken are repeatable.
So what does that have to do with the fact that you don't know what the colors are added? You don't know the colors that are added. So how do you know that's accurate?
I do not know to the algorithm and how it's using it.
So when we're doing that on small images, like
a marker in my hand or something like that, and you want to see what this is from a far distance away, it might be adding color that's not actually there, right?
It may be.
So the image that we're asking people to look at might not actually be an accurate representation of the original image. True?
It's possible.
Would it take something that was present? So the example I gave you with Michael.
Mm-hmm.
If you expand that, is it going to add more black pixels?
It will add, no, it will not. It will not add any more detail than what is originally there.
But it's going to add pixels. You just don't know what color they're going to be.
Correct.
Is it more difficult to do that in situations where the further away, meaning the distance from the photograph, the further the distance from the photograph, the more difficult it is, or the more pixels that need to be added to blow it up, right?
Saying more distance from the photograph, you mean the object depicted?
Right, yep. So the object depicted in the photograph, the further away that is, the more pixels need to be added when you enlarge it, right?
Correct, if you wanted to enlarge it, yes.
And the more pixels that are added, the more availability there is for distortion in terms of the color in those pixels, correct?
In terms of the color, it's possible.
And would that be also true? Would that be true for the size? I think I asked you this, but I'm trying to figure this out. The size of the image that you're trying to make that in, make larger, so the bigger the image in the photograph, the easier it is to enlarge?
There's more information, there's more pixels to their presence to enlarge in that area.
Okay. So if I, for example, was, if I had something on my clothing and you enlarged it, would that make the thing on my clothing more pronounced?
It may not, no.
Would it make it less pronounced?
It may not.
It may keep it the same even though the photograph is bigger?
Interpolation does not add detail. So if you are enlarging something on your clothing, all it's doing is making that image larger. The detail that may or may not be there is not added. You're not adding additional detail to that image.
You're just adding unknown information.
Yes. No, you're not adding unknown information. You're adding... You're interpolating those pixels, and you're adding those particular pixels.
Right, and those pixels contain information.
Yes.
And that information contains color.
Yes.
And you're not sure whether or not how that color scheme works in that situation, right?
I do not know.
Great. Right.
Sure, thank you.
Mr. Cost.
Do these programs add detail?
These programs do not add detail.
And how long did you work with this drone video all told?
All told, I received it on Sunday, and I finished all my work with it regards to these requests as of yesterday.
So you worked on it for more than 3 days?
Correct.
Would you have submitted a exhibit that did not seem to be consistent with the original footage?
Objection. And foundation.
It is argumentative.
Did you make sure that the... If the reports that you identified were not consistent with the drone footage that you become familiar with, would you have produced them?
I would not have produced them if there was any information in there that did not seem accurate to me.
So you do compare it to the original?
I did not compare it to the original in this instance, though.
And what is the sampling that you talk about?
The bicubic and smart resize.
Yes.
Those are two different algorithms that use to interpolate that information.
So do these algorithms look at, so let me ask this way. On a digital photograph, to make it bigger, do you have to add pixels?
You do have to add pixels, yes.
So if I take a photo from my phone and I want it on a 5x7, I'd be adding pixels to it.
You would be.
So this is something that's commonly done to photographs.
It is, yes.
Now, these algorithms, how do they know, to the best of your knowledge, how to add the pixels?
To my best of my knowledge, it depends on the algorithm, and that's the extent of my expertise on that.
So what is the sampling process?
The sampling process is looking at the pixels and providing more data to that.
So it looks at the pixels and looks at what's around it, and that's how it adds the pixels.
That's correct.
So it's not just arbitrarily choosing colors to put it?
Not to my knowledge.
Nothing further. Thank you.
So you never compared the photograph in front of you to the original? That's what you testified to?
I did not compare the original. I did my analysis on that original video, but I didn't compare them side by side, no.
Well, you were asked, you wouldn't submit it if you didn't think it was a fair and accurate representation and all the other stuff, right?
Right.
But you never looked at the two of them next to each other to confirm that, right?
To confirm that, to compare the original to the exported file, no.
And you, I know Mr. Cross talked about, you know, you take a photograph of your family or whatever and you make it bigger. You're probably not as concerned in a family photograph that you're adding pixels and where colors are going as you might be in, for example, say, a homicide investigation, right?
That is true.
Okay. So making sure that the information that's added to these pictures and the information is in the pixels, making sure that's accurate, that's an important part of your responsibilities, correct?
That would be, yes.
And you don't know how that happens in this particular case, correct?
I do not know the algorithm that's being used within the software to speak to that, no.
That's all I have to do.
You question? How do you know that the interpolation is accurate?
Just based off the fact that the if a bicubic algorithm is a common algorithm that is used, and it's a sound forensic tool within AMP5.
And how long did you work with this drone video and the different images from it?
It's sustained.
Do you know how many hours you worked out?
I would say it was approximately 20 hours.
Question?
I don't.
You may step down, sir.
No further involvement.
Any other evidence?
Then we move that the exhibit be accepted and published as previously requested.
Any objection?
Same objection that I noted.
It'll be received and published. Did you have some for publication due, or was that done? That was completed?
Yes.
Okay. All right, then. Folks, the evidence is closed, and I'm going to ask that you return to my... yes, you do. Go ahead.
Do we get the screens off?
did you end with?
So is it at 155? And now we'll please exit at 156.
Meet the world's fastest portable real-time translation device.
Hello.
Hello.
Bonjour.
And please don't talk about the case. All right, now you have driven me into submission with your request to argue on Monday, but I'm going to expect something in exchange, which is a cap on the length of your arguments. I figure, well, first of all, just we're going to do a more involved discussion on instructions and verdicts. Are there going to be any charges submitted to the jury other than what is in the information? Yes?
They will answer that, yes.
How many additional charges are you going to submit? Or request to submit?
I'm not sure if we finalized our request. Certainly, I count. Three and four. I think we've discussed on other counts, but the first degree homicide, first degree intentional homicide, we will ask for all lesser included. The attempted homicide to engage first grade, so we ask for the only one lesser included. We are not inclined to ask for lesser included on the reckless endangering safety charges. At this level, we're not inclined to ask unless you're included on count one to Mr. Rosenbaum, but I think we need to discuss that more fully.
Okay. Are there going to be any special instructions other than what you've already submitted and the sixth count affirmative defense instruction from either side?
I believe the state will be asking. Yeah, we discuss this more, but I think we'll be asking for the provocation instruction.
Well, the reason I'm asking right now, I'm not going to hold you to this, is that I figure that the instruction probably will take 45 minutes, I would think.
To read them to the jury?
Yeah.
Yes, I would say.
I would say easily.
And so that leaves how much of the day, since you scared me off from tomorrow because you said, well, the jury will be worn out by the time we get there. So I think, well, I don't want to wear them out on Monday either. So if I'm going to be instructing them for 45 minutes or an hour, that takes us to 10:30. So maybe if you were going to confine your arguments to maybe an hour and a half apiece, is that reasonable?
Very. I have a
question. Total time.
Including rebuttal?
Yeah. Total time.
The state is going to need 2 hours for our primary and I'd say a half an hour for rebuttal.
No. I had the good fortune to be across the street from you, to living across the street to the late Kenneth Grube, United States District Judge, when I was a lad. And Judge Grube is famous for his statement that the brain cannot absorb what the seat cannot endure. And if you don't like that advice, President Roosevelt, one of the renowned speakers of the 30s and 40s, when asked by his son for some advice on speaking, said, be sincere, be brief, and be seated. And so the message is loud and clear. Are you saying 2.5 hours to argue your case?
I'm saying that I think that the initial closing may take up to 2 hours. I'm not going to aim for 2 hours, Shannar, obviously. I understand that, but I want to have the freedom. There are a lot of videos, and we're going to be showing them. So there's going to need to be time for that. It's not just going to be standing up groaning for 2 hours, but there's going to be time when we're going to need several minutes. I don't even know, probably 30 minutes worth of video that they may be watching at various times, which no one's going to be talking. It'll just be playing that. And I certainly don't want to be in a situation where our allotted time for closing, you propose an hour and a half, for example, we do an hour and, 10 minutes or whatever to save 20 for rebuttal. Wait, I can't possibly budget rebuttal time because I don't know what the rebuttal is going to be. So I'd like that, we can put a cap of, 30 minutes or something on it, but I don't want that to come out of the first closing period of time. And I don't want to be limited. I don't want to have to budget that right now out of that first closing time. So if the court is disinclined to go along with that, then I would propose an hour and a half for our primary closing, an hour and a half for the defense, and then a maximum of 30 minutes for rebuttal.
You should give no more time than us.
Whatever. No, they won't.
Okay.
They won't.
Whatever the time
no.
the court says,
yeah.
I'll deal with it.
I
think an hour and a half is adequate.
I agree with you that, and you make a good point about the number of exhibits, and I'm going to indulge total time of 2.5 hours each side. But with that, I'm usually pretty permissive when people go a little bit longer than they should. I note it to the jury so that the jurors can make their own, if they get annoyed, they get annoyed. But I just warn the people that I'm going to be a little bit tougher. And I may tell you to just sit down in mid-sentence if it keeps going. No, seriously. And I did it. I did it to one of your one of the DAs that in the last several sequences and in mid-sentence. So 2.5 hours per side, and yours is to allocate as you wish. We need to come back tomorrow. Tonight, you may send me your proposals for lesser included and any special instructions or the numbers of those you want. Let's get the jurors in, then we'll take care of these details.
You're listening to the Marty Smith Show. One thing this judge is kind of like me.
Yeah, I think the crew will be happy to.
It's a 2.5 hour show, folks.
You can see on the right hand side of your screen, gloves, fits up, visors are down. The the suits again look a little puffy. Again, they're pressurized and they're being fed essentially nitrox to test if they can hold that pressure.
And again, these suits are very necessary during these dynamic portions of flight. Of course, they would protect the crew in the unlikely event of a cabin depressurization. And they, like you said, are made to fit them perfectly. The seats are made to fit them perfectly, so they're very comfortable on that climb uphill.
Yeah, the material themselves are also flame and chemical resistant. Again, more safety for the crew. They really are a spacecraft inside of a spacecraft. There is an umbilical that is attached from the thigh of the spacesuit to the chairs themselves. And this is really how one of the ways that the astronauts can communicate with the folks here on the ground.
And, of course, we'll need four good suit leak checks. Each crew member will have to report a good suit leak check to proceed. Again, just another step, another milestone to get them to the International Space Station today. Once they arrive, docking will happen in two phases. They'll have soft capture and then hard capture, which will mate them to the International Space Station. At that point, they could start pressurizing the vestibule and open those hatches to arrive at the International Space Station.
Again, this suit leak checkout is expected to last just a couple of minutes, and we should be hearing the updates for the status of the suit leak checkouts from the crew here shortly.
Again, you're getting a live look inside of Crew Dragon Endurance right now. For
and Dragon, see four good suit leak checks. Dragon Endurance, we see the same four good suit leak checks.
Okay, the crew and the ground team confirming four good suit leak checks. They're all functioning properly for the approach to dock with the International Space Station.
Yeah, another great milestone achieved here. Next one is we're going to be approaching waypoint one. That is 220 meters away from the International Space Station. That also lines up Dragon with the docking axis of the forward port, the Node 2 port. For its sort of final leg of the journey to docking with the International Space Station. So next up, Dragon does have the ability to perform a mid-course maneuver about halfway through the journey to waypoint one and eventually waypoint zero and eventually waypoint one. And this is to ensure that Dragon is positioned right under the station at 400 meters below.
So about halfway from our starting point of approach initiation to waypoint zero, Dragon will execute a small mid-course maneuver. This is just to fine-tune our approach to ensure we're targeting a precise point 400 meters directly below the International Space Station. That mid-course is expected in about 14 minutes if they need to execute that.
So to do all of these maneuvers and burns, Dragon utilizes the Draco engines. There are 16 of them sort of installed and built into the Dragon capsule really all around. And each of them can produce about 90 pounds of force in space. And if we do get views of Dragon as it
it gets closer and closer to the International Space Station, it looks like there are little light bulbs that you're just turning on and off a bunch of times. When you see those are the Draco engines firing, and they can really perform a lot of micro adjustments necessary, again, to make sure that Dragon is perfectly aligned to dock with the International Space Station.
With everything looking good over here on our end, let's check in with Sandra in Mission Control Houston. Sandra, how's everything going over there?
Thanks, Courtney. So far, everything continues to go smoothly over here as well. This afternoon, NASA astronaut Mark VandeHei woke up around 3 p.m. Central Time and had his post-sleep period, which just wrapped up a few minutes ago at 4 p.m. He's going to get right into preparing for the crew's arrival, and he'll use the station's cupola. He'll be in the station's cupola using special software to track Dragon's approach to make sure it stays in the expected zones. Once Dragon is docked, NASA astronaut Mark VandeHei will be primed to start hatch opening operations. He'll start by opening the large hatch on the Node 2 forward, giving him access into the pressurized mating adapter. The crew will then have to pressurize the vestibule, which is a small space between the hatches on the Dragon and space station. This was exposed to vacuum prior to docking, so the crew will need to fill it with air and make sure its pressure is nearly equal with the atmospheric pressure on Dragon and the station. VandeHei will use a small valve on that station's hatch to slowly introduce air into the station's vestibule, and flight controllers here in Houston will monitor and verify the pressure readings here to make sure that everything is leak-free before we get ready to open up the hatches. NASA Flight Director Rebecca Wingfield is leading teams here in Mission Control Houston for Dragon's approach and docking today. And to their right is the CAPCOM or TASPO communicator, Joshua Kirtrick, who will be communicating with the crew aboard station. Right now, there are three astronauts aboard the space station, including NASA's Mark VandeHei, which we have discussed, and Roscosmos cosmonauts Pyotr Dubrov and Anton Skaplerov, who is the current space station commander. Again, we're getting excited to get our crew three astronauts aboard, and that's the latest from here in Mission Control Houston. Back over to Hawthorne.
Thanks, Sandra. We're happy to hear that everything is going well over there, as it is over here in Hawthorne, too. Again, the crew just going through these milestones so quickly, running a little bit ahead of schedule. We've already completed the approach initiation burn. Coming up next is a mid-course maneuver burn. Again, that'll take Dragon to where he's positioned for his next milestone.
We can do this mid-course maneuver, and right now Dragon is approaching the International Space Station. It's going from about 2.5 kilometers underneath the Dragon, the International Space Station, to about 400 meters,
submitting your questions on social media using the hashtag AskNASA, and we'll continue to answer as many as we can here on air. Live view now from Mission Control Houston as we continue to work here to ensure the International Space Station is ready for Dragon.
Durham's not dragging the ground. Not a cool thing. We just wonder if you have any troubleshooting ideas. So on Tom's seat, we're getting like the sound of wind coming from his connections. We've tried closing his visors for sure. Pretty sure it's not external airflow. And we can get to go away if we do more his box sensitivity. But whenever he talks, there's like a sound of rushing wind. And even when he bounces on him, like a rushing wind sound coming from his helmet.
That dragon. So C3, you were getting the sound of rushing wind consistently, and adjusting the box levels did not resolve that issue. So we will take a look at what we can do here on the ground and come back with any recommendations.
Good job. like in a we are going to be getting that transport in front of
Mark, once driving, around that 400 meter mark below the international space station, it will be at
coming up next is Waypoint Zero. Again, that will be the first checkpoint during our approach. The vehicle will have the option to hold at that 400-meter mark, but if all systems check out, it can actually continue through to Waypoint One.
And the graphic on screen right now really is summarizes the journey that Dragon has had so far since separation from the second stage. It's gone through a number of phasing and burns to, again, slowly and methodically approach the International Space Station. We are so close right now, approaching that 400-meter mark, as you had described, Courtney. From here, there are a couple more checkpoints to reach. At that 400-meter mark, it is at Waypoint Zero. Waypoint 1 is at 220 meters, and Waypoint 2 is inside the keep-out sphere, which is that 200-meter radius imaginary sphere, if you will, where there's like a six-hour safe trajectory. Waypoint 2 is 20 meters away. And then from there, we're going to get closer and closer and eventually dock and rendezvous with the International Space Station.
Yes, at Waypoint 2, they'll do that last final hold. They'll do that final go, no-go pull before their final approach to the International Space Station for docking today. We'll have another go, no-go coming up in about 2 minutes and 30 seconds. That'll be the go, no-go pull for Waypoint 0. They'll decide then if they want to continue through to Waypoint 1 or go ahead and hold there to get their phasing right.
Yeah, and again, just a few minutes ago, we performed our mid-course maneuver burn. This is exactly what it has described. It happens about halfway between the approach to Waypoint Zero. So we still have a couple more minutes to reach Waypoint Zero. The Dragon spacecraft is doing a couple of things. It's making sure that its navigation lights are on. These are green and red lights underneath the nose cone that we should get used up later. It's also making sure that its video is being configured correctly for docking and aligning itself with the docking access. Here is a great view. This is a live view inside the capsule. And now this view is the cruise view of the International Space Station.
Yep, that's our first view of the International Space Station. That will continue to get clearer as Dragon moves closer, but this is a camera aboard Dragon capturing the International Space Station.
Yeah, it looks like the sun is right on it, so it is daytime. Daytime in the International Space Station. On the side of the International Space Station, you can see the solar arrays. Nice and big, those are capturing all the sun's energy. And again, that is what translates into power for the International Space Station.
And it looks like the International Space Station right now is going over the southern tip of Asia, Dragon poised to catch it.
Yeah, the International Space Station, it's really a global effort, multinational effort. It's been up there for over 20 years. Again, we mentioned earlier in the broadcast about all the experiments that are happening, not only as part of this mission, but are ongoing currently as part of some of the other expeditions that are happening.
And a great view now over the Pacific Ocean.
Yes, so this view is from the International Space Station looking down. A little to the left of the center of the screen, that white dot, that is the Dragon. That is the capsule Endurance. The crew is inside, and again, they are in the middle of their approach to Waypoint Zero, which is about 400 meters below the International Space Station. If we were to keep this view up there. And copy that, Dragon. Good news.
Okay, so some more good comms checks. On the left side of your screen, you can see from a camera aboard the International Space Station, Dragon flying below it between the International Space Station and the Earth. And on the right side of your screen is the International Space Station from a camera on Dragon.
The crew themselves actually got a look at the International Space Station a few hours ago, and they had described it as quite emotional, knowing that, one, this is their their destination and two, their home for the next 6 months.
If you gotta leave it to me, make sure you feel the heat. You can take what you like.
Looks like Dragon is just under 9 minutes from arriving at waypoint zero.
Just saw, I believe, on the left-hand side of that previous view, that was Commander Raja Chari, and to his right was Pilot Thomas Harshburn. They were going through the display panels in Dragon. Those displays have a lot of information the crew can keep track of, which straightful engines are firing, their trajectory, where they're at in space. Zero and will be enabling the producer shortly. The expected start time is per year display. Reminder that Dragon will nominally continue its approach through waypoint 1 towards waypoint 2 without stopping. I copy.
When you take it from me, I'll make sure that you follow the plan.
That is Grand Pulse for Zero.
So what can we play? Is it too much to ask if I should go or I should stay?
Alright, for confirmation that they will just go straight through waypoint zero onto waypoint 1, 220 meters away.
If you're sitting on the big loop, you can expect a third monitor and Dragon and approximately 35-3
There's the display panels again. Tom Arsper and Raja Chari working on those right now. Of course, Dragon does fly autonomously, so they're just following along with the telemetry and data on those display panels.
This is a fantastic view. Dragon is now in the upper right-hand corner of your screen with Earth in the background.
Dragon and the International Space Station are about to fly over Indonesia.
Again, it does look like they are not moving that fast, but trust me, they are 17,500 miles an hour. That is 20 times the speed of sound. That is the speed that both Dragon and the International Space Station are moving at, and this approach, this dance-like approach that is underway, that happens at those speeds.
The International Space Station sees 16 sunrises and sunsets a day, so we may see Dragon go from an orbital nighttime to an orbital daytime during its approach to the International Space Station. If you're just joining us, Dragon is on its way to waypoint zero, 400 meters below the International Space Station. From there, it will swing up and out in front of the International Space Station at 220 meters at waypoint one. From there, they'll pause or they may decide to go straight through that one to waypoint two, inside of the Keep Out Sphere, about 20 meters away from the International Space Station. That'll be the final pause before giving that final go-no-go approach to dock with the International Space Station.